A judge says dredging can begin in the St. John's River. Jaguars owner Shad Khan is named to an NFL committee on social justice. And Jacksonville's own Lynyrd Skynyrd says they're going out on their farewell tour. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live on the radio at 9. Also, never miss a show. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and through our app. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday Roundtable. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, we've got a look ahead to Congaree and Penn Farms' big olive weekend. Yeah, olive farming right here in Florida. Plus, don't miss the live in-studio performance from Florida native Ben Spaccaro and The New Effect. It's a preview of their gig in town this weekend. All of that ahead, but first, it's Friday, and time to look back at a very busy news week as we welcome Folio Weekly editor Claire Goforth. Hey, Claire, good to see you.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Board member and WJCT contributor Charles Griggs is here.
Good morning.
And A.G. Gankarski of Florida Politics.
Hello.
Good to see all of you, and lots to talk about this Friday. Lots of news this week, everything from the latest point-in-time homeless count in Jacksonville. They do that every year. We'll tell you about that. The boys from Jacksonville's West Side, yes, Lynyrd Skynyrd. They're as free as a bird now, going out on their farewell tour this spring. That is
another
happening.
One?
Yeah, another one. That and more ahead that caught our eye this week in terms of headlines. But our top story this morning, a federal judge has ruled against the St. John's Riverkeeper to temporarily halt Jacksport's proposed deepening of a section of the St. John's River. The Riverkeeper wanted the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to redo its 2014 impact report because Jacksport had changed the number of miles that they wanted to dredge the river from 13 to 11. More recently, the Riverkeeper had also amended its April 2017 complaint, arguing that after that historic flooding we all suffered through after Hurricane Irma, well, they thought the Corps should be made to do more risk analysis of the dredging project. They argued the flooding proves that the dredging could eventually result in more negative environmental impact to this area. But in rejecting the Riverkeeper's motion, U.S. District Judge Marsha Morales Howard said the organization just hadn't made their case, that they hadn't proven changing the project length affected the Corps' initial impact study. Now, Howard left the door open to the Riverkeeper challenging the Corps' flood models when more information is available. The Riverkeeper says it will continue raising the alarm about this. At the same time, Jacksport spokeswoman Nancy Rubin says they're excited about the judge's decision and that dredging the river will help the city's economy. We're going to begin the hour with a closer look. Where do you stand on plans to dredge the St. John's River down to a depth of 47 feet? The idea is to attract bigger cargo ships to Jacksport and theoretically grow jobs in the economy in this area. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online and send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And let us know your thoughts about the biggest stories of the week on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Claire Goforth, let's begin with you. The judge issued her ruling saying that the Riverkeeper hadn't proven their case when it came to this particular part of their complaint. She did leave the door open for them to pursue legal action more broadly. And of course, we can expect more legal action.
We certainly can. I think that as a community, we really need to examine this dredge and ask ourselves whether or not this is going to have both the economic benefits that the port is claiming and also cause minimal environmental damage like they are also claiming. They have a very minimal amount of environmental mitigation in the dredging plan. $3 million is seen as a drop in the bucket. And then when it comes to the economic impact, they're saying that it's going to bring this boom of jobs and all of this money flowing into Northeast Florida. But we all know that as ports have become increasingly automated, those economic impacts are really experienced by a very small number of people, usually the high dollar interests, the people who own these terminals. And more to the point, this Martin Associates, who conducted this economic impact analysis, has repeatedly found that regardless of the circumstances, every single dredging project is going to be a boom for the local economy. When the fact of the matter is that Savannah is miles ahead of Jacksport in their dredging project, and Miami is also miles ahead of Jacksport in their dredging project. So how is Jacksport going to get all of this Asian cargo that they're going after when there's a finite amount of cargo every year, and we're only going to get a certain piece of that pie? It doesn't really seem like it's going to grow very much.
Yeah, well, the issue also is that these particular types of projects, there are so many unknowns about them. And when Riverkeeper came in and said that because of the Hurricane Irma and all of the uncertainties around the flooding that occurred around that, there are more questions to be asked and more, we need more answers. However, when you're dealing with an organization like Jacksport, whose job it is to make sure that commerce happens, they're going to make these types of predictions, and they're hired. This is what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to create opportunities like this where they can see where the growth is going to take place. So it Riverkeeper's point is, has to be where they're providing pushback. But this is going to go on for a while until we see some actual dredging happen and see some results from that. And I think the unknown part of that is won't manifest itself until we actually see some things happen.
It's 549-2937 to join the show. Now, A.G. Gankarski, leaving aside the environmental back and forth over this, let's just talk about the facts on the ground. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers awarded the dredging contract to a company called the Dutra Group back in September, this according to the Times Union. They're currently wrapping up a project down at Port Canaveral. They're expected to move their equipment up here this month by the end of the month. That's according to the U.S. Department of Justice. And once the equipment is in place, the Corps will start incurring costs for the dredge, whether or not they're even doing any work. So the tab is going to start running even if the dredging's not even physically taking place yet.
Yeah, the meter's running. The dredging is going to move forward, legal challenges notwithstanding. And, our city power brokers are depending on it. Something that Rick Scott said was going to be in play. This is going to be a promises made, promises kept thing. There are reasons that dredging may have a benefit, deeper harbor. I mean, that's one thing, deepening the channel. Another thing is, if you look at what's happening to the dollar, it's lost 30% of its value in the last year. This is Donald Trump's strategy to weaken the dollar, what he said at Davos notwithstanding. That's clearly what's happening. And the idea is to onshore more production. We saw Project Volt, a solar panel factory approved by city council on Tuesday. That's 800 jobs locally. And the idea is that onshoring production, weaker dollar combined with tariffs, is going to create more jobs. We're going to see more things like that, come into play. Is that going to make up for the environmental impacts that are certainly going to happen? I mean, look at Miami. Miami has issue coral reefs that, wasn't really something that the Army Corps of Engineers said was going to happen, but something that environmentalists said was going to happen, and indeed it has. But this is a cost-benefit analysis, and, policymakers, federal, state, and local have said, hey, to make this happen, to, get the economic growth you want to get here, we got to get this dredging happening, and it's moving forward.
It is going to cost somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 million to dredge this portion of the shipping channel of the river down from 40 feet to 47 feet to accommodate what are known as Panamax-ready ships, larger ships that are coming through an expanded, a wider Panama Canal. Actually, an 11-mile deepening would reduce the cost to $484 million. Claire Goforth, the Riverkeeper's lawsuit says the economic justification just isn't enough to justify that expense, and how will it be paid for? Of course, business groups, the city's political elite, by and large have said they think it's worth the cost, that they think the jobs will materialize.
Of course they do. I mean, that's their position to take. But, you know, the port right now, they're pursuing this dredging without any appropriation of funds from the city. And sometime last summer, there was a call for some workshops about this. And then City Council President Anna Broche, she came out with this list of reasons. It basically amounted to Jaxport owns the river. And I'd like to know who gave them the St. John's River, because it belongs to all of us. And yet they are pursuing this dredging plan without regard to the very real concerns about environmental impacts, the flooding. I mean, what we saw with Hurricane Irma, that's before the dredge. Just think of what it's going to be when we add up to a foot of flooding. I mean, 1 foot makes a huge difference in terms of a flood. And last time we dredged, subsequently, there were mass deaths of dolphins, there were mass fish kills, and there were algal blooms, serious algal blooms, and there was something, a toxic foam in the river subsequently. Now, we don't know for sure that had something to do with the dredging, but when you dredge a river and then subsequently you have serious environmental repercussions, you have to say there's some sort of cause and effect there.
That was the argument the riverkeeper made, Charles, that the judge rejected, that Irma showed additional storm surge from a deeper river could cause even more catastrophic harm.
Yeah, so I think that the opinion here is, from the judge's perspective, is that you don't know that for certain. You need another two or three Irmas to, you know, to validate that. But on the riverkeeper's point is that, you know, we don't want to wait for another Irma to happen to have even more harm done to our environment here locally. We need to step back and take a look at what the environmental impacts will be now before we let it go forward. But I think that because the judge left the door open, the riverkeeper would probably go back and try to find more evidence that something is imminent is here. But at the same time, you know, like AG said, you know, this is going to go forward. You know, we've got, you know, people already lined up to do the business of dredging. And, you know, the judge's order notwithstanding, in the immediate near future, this is going to happen. So we probably need to start looking at the positive impacts and how we can sort of work on the environmental mitigation along the way instead of trying to stop the project as it goes forward.
You know, and there's a reality here, too. I mean, the riverkeeper filed motions till the cows come home, and probably will. But City Council is not going to get involved with this. Broche was basically the best shot they had. Broche spiked it. City Council president next year is going to be Aaron Bowman, you know, Jacksonville Chamber representative on the council. You know, beyond that, you're going to have like a new class of people come in. Many of them are going to be Lenny Curry's choices, people backed by Curry's political machine. They're going to back the Jaxport mayor's office play. They're basically walking in sync. So you're not going to get that oversight until the bills start coming due on the city level, if and when they do. But even then, it's going to be too late for it to matter. It's just going to be basically appropriate the money. And the question will be, well, where does the money come from? That's a question for future budgets. But, you know, City Council has punted on this, and it's going to continue to.
If you're just tuning in, give us a call. Where do you stand on plans to dredge the St. John's River? 549-2937 to join our lively, brilliant, and scintillating Friday Media Roundtable. Let's go to Steve in Orange Park right now. Hey, Steve, good morning. Happy Friday.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'll take my answer off the air. I just wanted to know if anyone had thought of the impact of an increasing amount of 3D printers on shipping and how that would affect this project.
The increasing the impact of 3D printers on shipping, you mean in terms of more of them being shipped into the United States?
You know, as far as more people being able to print their products, mm-hmm. and this is a project that's going to take, you know, a certain amount of time. So if we look out a year, 2 years out, there'd definitely be more 3D printers and fewer products needing to be shipped.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, yeah, sure. Yeah. No, I get you. And you know, he's right. That affects a whole array of products.
Well,
that affects fashion. That affects, there are so many products that are going to be revolutionized by that technology. So that's a good point.
Certainly. We may want to also ask about the eventual economic downturn and how that is going to affect us as there are less goods being shipped in and out, possibly in the future. We know we've had economic good times for some years now and it can't last. Once it does go down, will we be in a situation where we have less in the city coffer? We're spending on all of these projects hundreds of millions of dollars, and the people are suffering because we've already basically obligated ourselves to pay hundreds of millions of dollars, not only for the dredge, but for the possible environmental impacts.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. $700 million potentially is a lot of money. And some people even forecast that number is not real. But at the same time, you've got the port and the Army Corps are sort of, I don't want to say guaranteeing, but they're saying, listen, this is our business. We can tell you, we can forecast how this is supposed to come out, how what we're going to do, and we're going to create 800, jobs, and the economic impact is going to be worth the dollars spent, even if we have to suffer some or we deal with the environmental mitigations as we go along with the project.
Cindy is in Springfield. Hey, Cindy, what are your thoughts?
My thoughts are that with the needs that the city has right now, an expanding homeless population, high poverty rate, crime rate, it just seems like the city is willing to spend a lot of money on these large infrastructure projects that have a very nebulous return or impact on the health and well-being of the community. There's so many negative factors. And I feel like on top of that, we've just had an historic weather event that flooded downtown. And I think it's irresponsible to dredge the river out with all these things that are germane to the issue.
Thanks for that, Cindy. And, we're getting tweets and emails to that effect, too, from some listeners. Here's one from a listener. Jay tweets the show, if the city can find hundreds of millions to subsidize dredging, why can't they find the money to develop the riverfront? That would produce more jobs and economic impact overall. Do you guys agree or disagree with that?
Here's the thing. You've got a mayor who's on his third year now, and he's doing third-year projects like the district, like this, and so on. These are legacy kind of projects he's doing. And the Democrats aren't running a single person against him. We are almost a year out from the election, and there's not even a single filed Democratic candidate. That's political malpractice. So, if you're Lenny Curry and you're making decisions, you feel emboldened by the fact you have no significant political opposition. Every so often you get Garrett Dennis saying something in council and the rest of council just basically beats him down. Anna Brochet, she's in the same position. So, Lenny Curry's moving the ball forward because nobody's standing up to him. Nobody's basically saying, well, we need to take these things into account. People's objections fundamentally don't matter here.
And that necessarily, that really has to come from the people. I mean, the citizens, like they're calling in and they're tweeting. If that's important to them, they have to make their position known to the elected officials so it can be addressed. Now, that doesn't guarantee that it's going to be addressed immediately. But if they, this is what our democracy is built on. If you feel strongly enough about these priorities, you have to step up and say something and do something about it. But right now, those priorities are economic development and projects that are going to bring more money or potentially bring more money into the coffers of the economy.
Bill emails the show, Panamax depth, 50 feet, Jacksport, 47 feet. Do the math. The depth isn't there. This is a boondoggle that will add to the uphill climb the city is facing with the pension problem. Here is a comment on our Facebook page. Well, if we balance our trade with Asia, how much will the finite amount of cargo decrease?
Okay. We're killing the dollar. So if we keep crashing the dollar, then eventually more cost effective to manufacture here. Of course, we're going to be competing with countries where the standard of living is much lower per capita. But, that doesn't matter to national policymakers. I mean, when you see the dollar doing what it's been doing over the last year and you see no real interruption in it, and you've got a myopic national media that talks about how great the stock market's doing while ignoring economic indicators, well, that's what you get.
Here's another tweet from M. O'Connell. With impending sea level rise, do we really need to dredge? Most of the people making this decision don't accept that the ocean is rising to begin with.
At least not publicly. I think it is worthy to note that the Army Corps of Engineers did not even conduct a multi-port analysis when they looked at this project because their words did not foresee Jacksport getting a significant amount of cargo from its closest competitors.
Terry is in San Marco. Go ahead, Terry.
Yes, I, with a number of ports up and down the East Coast, they claim that the real winner here is that it makes a more competitive environment for the very people that are owning the goods and doing the shipping. No money comes to really the people. It'll actually drive the wages down of all the rest of the people who work in the rest of the ports on the East Coast. So to create more ports is to drive labor price lower at the cost of the taxpayer to put the port in.
Okay, thanks for that. But to talk about the port's position, the chamber position, the city's position, what about their argument that, look, this could create up to 5,000 jobs, good-paying jobs? That's a pretty strong argument if it bears out.
It sounds good in theory, right? But when you sort of map it out and look at specifically where those jobs are being created, then there are enough questions there that people have doubt about in the relevance of those, the actuality of those jobs going to be created, how many of those jobs can be created. But at the same time, when we look at how these projects have, the questions alongside, we've got the perfect position here in Jacksonville's port where, you know, you have the transportation hub. But that hasn't really bared out to make the argument for the case against taking the risk for the environmental circumstances. So those people who are looking at the economic development impacts aren't really selling those people who are looking at the risk to the environment.
All right. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the biggest stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. We're going to talk about the Jaguars for a minute, but not about the big loss to the hated New England Patriots. Boo! Hiss!
And the referees. Don't forget those refs.
They are the worst. I'm sorry. It was pretty obvious, wasn't it? I'm sorry. But we're not talking about that aspect of football. We want you to call us right now about something else. It's 549-2937 to join us. Now, also making headlines this week, Jaguars owner Shad Khan has been named to a new NFL committee that focuses on social justice. According to the NFL, the campaign called Let's Learn Together will include a multi-layered rollout that includes digital content and spots that highlight player-led work on social and racial equality. Khan says he himself has experienced injustice in his life. Now, you might remember when it was first announced that Khan had bought the Jaguar franchise, he was hammered by some people in this area for being a Muslim. Khan was born in Pakistan and came to America at the age of 16 to attend college with no money, no prospects. He went on to become, of course, a billionaire, and he is the first ethnic minority owner of an NFL team. What are your thoughts about the NFL's new Social Justice Committee? Give us a call at 549-2937. The working group includes Khan, Cardinals owner Michael Bidwill, Falcons owner Arthur Blank, Browns owner Jimmy Haslam, Miami Dolphins owner Stephen Ross. And there are some other names on there, too, including quite a few players. Claire Goforth, you know, the NFL, where the majority of players are African-American, is getting out in front of this issue, particularly as they've gone through the fire of the whole taking a knee controversy for the past year. This is an interesting play by the NFL.
It is. I mean, you could be cynical and say that it's a marketing campaign designed to make the NFL look good, or you could be optimistic and say that it's a symbolic effort to take a leadership role on a serious issue affecting the African American and other minority communities. And I mean, NFL players are some of the most well-known and visible minorities in the country, and of course these issues are very deep, you know, that they're close to their hearts. And the NFL should at least be congratulated for making an effort. Although, you know, a league that was to make $13 billion in 2016 to spend $90 million over 7 years, about $13 million a year. I mean, it's not that much money when you put it into that perspective, but it's something. It's a step in the right direction.
That's basically what Alan Hearns gets paid. I mean, let's be perspective here. I mean, come on. This is all because the NFL couldn't bring itself to lift the blacklist against Colin Kaepernick, because Colin Kaepernick kneeled and actually protested. You know, this is damage control. This Let's Learn Together is going to accomplish absolutely nothing except for some feel-good optics that, you know, your NFL commentators and your NFL studio teams can have little plinky piano segments as somebody goes into the community and does this or that or the other. This is a big ball of nothing. And you know, Shad Khan putting his name on this doesn't exactly redeem it. The NFL.
Do you think real social justice would involve an NFL owner hiring Kaepernick?
No, it would have been a start. They hired Michael Vick.
That ship has come and gone for Kaepernick, and the fact that Shad Khan is on this committee, I think, is a step in the right direction because he's been one of the folks that's been the most vocal progressively.
Now, tell that to the Flexing Gate people in Illinois, the union buster.
Well, the thing is, the pressure is not really on him. The pressure is going to be on the players that are participating in this committee because they're going to be the ones held accountable that they're not able to speak truth to power if things go awry. This is a start, and they can turn this into whatever is something special if they let it. They need to take a page out of the NBA's playbook. The NBA has been well out in front on how they work with their players as partners and doing social justice projects. They listen.
Some examples of that,
well,
Charles?
Some examples of are how, like LeBron James. LeBron James, you know, markets his group of organization. He's encouraged to give, and he gets his team to support his giving to education and projects like that. If the ownership of the NFL decides to work alongside the players in a meaningful way, then this will make a difference because many of the players have their own projects, their own foundations that do good work in the communities across the country.
The players are more interested in getting off Thursday night football games and dealing with CTE and these other issues than they are in this particular initiative. I mean, that's the reality.
Some players.
Yeah.
No, I mean, if you follow the NFL closely, the big objection is Thursday night football games. The big objection is the upcoming labor agreement. These are things that are really worried about. I mean, this social justice committee, you've got Josh McCown on it. Josh McCown is a 38-year-old white dude. He's basically going to be out of the league in a year or two. Anquan Boldin, he's a former player who's on this committee. Aeneas Williams, he played 10 years ago. Josh Norman, he's actually an active player. Hurrah. But
Anquan Boldin's brother was actually killed by a police officer. So, again, the players are going to be the ones held accountable here because they're the ones who have knowledge of what's going on in the community, and they can inform owners on what they need to have working alongside of them in order to make a difference. If people like Aeneas Williams, who attended Southern University, who has a deep roots in his community, Calvin Beecham was here. And Calvin Beecham was here 1 year. And he did some, you know, he was trying to work in the community here. So we know that a lot of these players, they are very passionate about what they do in the community and some of the issues related to social
justice.
There
are individual Jaguars players, both current and former, who on an individual level do what they can in this community to, you know, practice what
they
preach.
The foundation is a great write-off.
Yeah, beyond a write-off, though, seriously, they really do try to do good in the community. But I think I take AG's point completely in that the NFL has a long way to go.
They do.
When it comes to actually getting right on this issue, I think that's a very fair point.
I mean,
point.
The NFL was predicated on age discrimination. It's like, you know, if you're 30 years old and you're a running back, you're basically out of the league. It's like
that's
working in media.
That's not age discrimination.
That way.
It's about performance. Let's be realistic about
that.
No,
it's about salary cuts. It's about keeping salaries down because they have this ridiculous salary cap.
Tom Brady's still throwing the football at the age of 40.
Well, Tom Brady's also marketed. I mean, that's the reason, you know, that's the reason he's there. He's basically able to be marketed. You can't market a 30-year-old running back. You can market a 40-year-old white quarterback, the Tom Cruise of the NFL.
Especially if you cheat.
Yeah.
But back to the point. I mean, I have personally been at charity events where Jaguar players were there donating their time to underprivileged kids who have gone out of their way to help their community. Yeah. You can't paint them all with the same brush.
Yeah, the NFL
you can
is
paint
no
the
different.
League with the same brush.
The NFL is no different than, you know, insert bank name here. You know, they are an organization, a corporation who's trying to make money. They're, you know, that's what they're doing. But they have to respond to the wishes of the marketplace. And in this case, the product they offer happens to be other human beings on the field.
And what about the fact that out of all, what about the fact that Khan, as I pointed out, the first minority owner of an NFL team, you know, linked arms with his players in London, took a lot of heat for that. Mm-hmm. You know, now we saw what happened with players taking a knee. It's going to be interesting to see what Khan does on this committee in this community, and what this committee does in this community and around the country. This is going to be a fascinating thing to watch play out.
Every time they talk about the NFL's response to kneeling and the owner's response, they show Shah Khan locking arms with the Jaguar players over in London. And the reason why they do that,
I'm not saying I agree or disagree with it. I'm just saying that was a flashpoint moment.
Khan took a heat from a bunch of 65-year-old mouth breeders whose main goal in life is getting to the Golden Corral buffet before it gets dark because they don't want to get ambushed in the parking lot. I mean, these people are dying out. Shah Khan make a calculated choice to kneel to participate with his players.
You don't think that was sincere?
He could have followed Jerry Jones.
Whether it was sincere or not, it was calculated. You think Shah Khan is doing anything that isn't like focus grouped and thought out? Y'all are insane.
He's a billionaire. He's doing whatever he wants. He's 67 years old.
He is doing what he wants, but I guarantee he's poll tested.
I don't know that I agree with that. I think his life experience might have had something to do with him making that decision.
Tell that to the Flexengate employees in Illinois. We don't see what happens in Illinois. He keeps it like basically cordoned off for a reason. We don't know Shah Khan, the ruthless business owner. What we know is Shah Khan coming through on the kismet.
All right, let's take one more call. AJ in St. Augustine.
Good morning, everybody. Happy New Year. I guess my comment will be, I think it's a good idea for them to have this social justice thing, but I think they should include community leaders, young people that's connected to the community. A lot of these NFL players and owners have been disconnected from the community for a long time. They have the right intentions, but a lot of them don't really know what's going on in the community. So I think they should have local community leaders and young people and anybody that care involved in the process. And that would be my suggestion.
Thanks, AJ.
That's a great point. And part of the plan of this initiative is supposed to be to search out and work with individual teams on organizations and developing relationships with organizations within the community. So that's a small part of the plan. It's not the whole piece.
All right. And they have faced numerous tragedies over the years and many ups and downs. But this week, Jacksonville's favorite sons and rock and roll Hall of Famers Lynyrd Skynyrd announced they're going out again on their farewell tour. If you turn on 96.9 The Eagle, you'll hear this only about every 5 minutes. I love this song, though. You know, the tour will be a concert series that features some of the best-known artists around. Lynyrd Skynyrd's farewell tour will also feature Kid Rock, Hank Williams Jr., Bad Company, the Marshall Tucker Band, and 38 Special. They have ties
Marshall
to this.
Tucker.
They have ties to this area, too. The boys from the West Side going out on a farewell tour. Tickets go on sale February 2nd at Live Nation. Jacqueline writes on our First Coast Connect Facebook page, I checked the website and there is not a single date scheduled on the farewell tour for Jacksonville.
God willing, the creep
they're
don't
still
rise
announcing
days.
Dates. This farewell tour could take, they said, I wrote in the paper this morning, up to 2 years.
Wow.
So we'll be saying goodbye for a long time.
Well, what a ride for Jacksonville's own Van Zandt boys.
Yeah, fun fact, I went to middle school with Johnny Van Zandt.
Get out of here. Did you have Lynyrd Skynyrd as a teacher?
Middle school. That was
Lake. Oh, that was high school.
I was at Lake Shore.
That's right. Yeah. You know, Charles, you are just one of the coolest guys I know. Have I ever told you that?
Oh, no, thank you very much.
And finally, it's our look at the strange, bizarre, and just plain ridiculous from around the state this week. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now, only in Florida. And only in Florida do our lawmakers actually surprise us once in a while and every now and again do something that we all like. Yes. Lawmakers in Tallahassee are looking at joining just two other states that have daylight savings time all year round. Two current bills called the Sunshine Protection Act would ask Congress to give Florida permission to make daylight savings time in the state permanent. The proposals, SB 858 and HB 1013, each passed the first Senate and House committees this week.
Of course they did.
Unanimously, if Congress agrees, Florida would join two other states that have exempted themselves from the 1966 law that sets a uniform time for all time zones. Hawaii and Arizona are on standard time year-round, but they're the only states.
I guess the legislature's corporate paymasters haven't put a position down on this yet.
That's right. And only in Florida does a couple celebrate the Jaguars' amazing season by naming their newborn daughter after two star players. Little Blake Ramsey Miller came into the world one day after the Jaguars exited the playoffs. She's named, of course, after Blake Bortles and Jalen Ramsey.
Oh, shucks.
Yep. Scott and Ashley Miller promised to raise their daughter as a big Jaguars fan. Dad Scott said they rejected naming her either Telvin or Leonard because those just aren't good names for a girl.
She's so going to grow up a Titans fan. You just know it.
I have a question about
you. My child left, which is missing somebody.
I don't know about Baselli is a good name for a daughter. Or
good name for a lobbyist.
Am I going to have to set my watch back every time I go to Valdosta?
Yeah, that sounds good work.
But why would you get a Valdosta?
Oh, you guys are bad.
They're out of the market.
Thanks so much and have a great weekend. Charles Griggs, Claire Goforth, and A.G. Gankarski always adding so much delight to our Fridays.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
We'll be right back.
Calling all educators, WJCT and Community First Credit Union are proud to present the 5th Annual Teach Conference, an event created by teachers to engage, empower, and inspire. Saturday, February 10th at the Hyatt Regency Hotel. Tickets are $30. Tickets purchased for the 2016 and 2017 events will be honored. Share ideas with colleagues, learn new ways to engage students, and empower yourself to inspire others. Bring a friend and get your tickets today at wjct.org/teach.
I'm Stephen Dubner, host of Freakonomics Radio. Every week, Freakonomics Radio explores the hidden side of everything, from what our Google searches reveal about us, to whether the American dream is still alive, to whether rich people are really more selfish than poor people. I hope you'll join me Sunday at 1 p.m. on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Jazz Night in America, Fred Hirsch, the poet-pianist, and his piece dealing with the poetry of Walt Whitman, Leaves of Grass.
Or sometimes when I meet people and they say, that Whitman album helped me get through a really terrible time in my life. And I'd like to think that it's, you know, humbly because of the music, but it's also the words.
I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT. Join us Sunday nights for fresh programming beginning at 9 with On the Beam with me, David Luckin, as we spotlight music from the 30s and 40s.
I'm on the beam, time's flying by.
Followed by Taste Test with host Damian Lamar presenting Urban Radio After Dark.
There is a place that I'm saving.
On the Beam and Taste Test, Sunday nights at 9, only on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world, your music.
Welcome back. Well, local farm Congaree and Penn is hosting an olive weekend Saturday and Sunday. Now, this weekend is going to feature a farm-to-fork olive dinner and a chance to check out the farm. If you've never been to a real working farm, you need to come out, bring the kids. This is a neat opportunity. At this Open Farm Day, you'll have the chance to learn about growing olives in Florida. Actually, buy your own olive tree for your yard. Participate in workshops, go on a wagon ride, even participate in some olive oil and wine tastings. Scott Meyer operates Congaree and Penn Farm, and he joins us now in studio. Hey, Scott, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me today.
Oh, sure. Good to see you. And it's so exciting to hear about this because I tend to think of you as a rice farmer, and now I'm hearing you're growing olives.
Yeah, that's right. So we started growing rice and then kind of quickly evolved into trying some orchard crops. My father, as well as our partner Bob Burns, has been growing trees in North Florida for over 30 years, and it was only the right thing. And, you know, olives have actually been growing in North Florida for several hundred years. The Spanish brought them over, and they grow quite well here.
I had no idea. I think of olives as something that you grow in Spain or Italy, like you said, but you can, is the climate and the soil good for that here?
Yeah, there's certain soil types around the area that are good. They prefer a well-drained, almost kind of like a poor, very well-drained soil. However, we're kind of bed-rowing them on our farm in Jacksonville to kind of keep those root systems dry, and then we're planning to plant a larger planting in a deeper sandy soil up in Charlton County, Georgia.
Very nice. So it's Olive Weekend at Congaree and Penn. What's going to be happening? How can people participate in all this fun?
Sure. So we're kicking the weekend off tomorrow night with the Noche de Oliva dinner, which is going to be prepared by Chef Ryan Randolph. He's been preparing some octopus and lamb belly and
octopus,
all sorts of great things. So it's a little bit of a Mediterranean feast. Uh-huh. However, unfortunately, we are all sold out for that event, but we're going to have a great day on Sunday. We're going to be having, like you said, wine tastings with Kylie Efron, as well as Barry Knoll from Stackhole Winery. They'll be out of the farm. There's still a few spots left for those tastings. We'll also have a growing olive tree course, which is going to be administered by Bob Burns. And then we also will have my father, Jeff, who's going to be kind of teaching a class. If anyone wants to actually get into the business side of growing olives, maybe on a slightly larger scale. And I'll be doing some walking tours. There's still some spots left to kind of tour the whole farm by foot with me and hear all about our plans and vision and how we got to where we are today.
How big is Congaree and Penn? Because you used to bill yourself as the world's tiniest rice farm.
And we still are a very small rice farm, but we're kind of expanding on the orchard side of things. So right now we're growing about 30 acres of mayhaw trees, which is a native fruit-bearing hawthorn. And then we'll be planning out over the next several years a couple hundred acres of orchards, both in the mayhaw trees and olive trees, as well as some pecan trees.
You are part of a movement, really an international movement, of farm to table and growing local sustainable agriculture. People just want to eat foods that are whole, that are sustainable, and that are grown close to where they live.
That's right. And that's really, the big part of that is really kind of knowing where your food is coming from. And if you go looking in any industry in the food world, whether it be seafood or whether it be your grain crops, the supply chain is not always as transparent as the consumer would like. And the easiest way is to buy direct from a farm and really know where your food's coming from. And it's always going to taste better, too, because the crops can be grown in a way in which that they don't necessarily have to be able to withstand the shipping, you know, in the long term, you know, time it takes to get from a farm all the way to where you're going to be consuming that food.
And wine tastings are great. And I would think olive oil tastings would be interesting too.
Yeah. So a lot of people really, unless they've had a great experience being able to go to Italy or go to Spain and really be at one of these old world olive mills, most people haven't really tasted the great quality of olive oil. However, olive oil sommelier Trey Hardinger will be demonstrating the true qualities of great olive oil on Sunday.
It's Olive Weekend at Congaree and Penn. They are located at 11830 Old Kings Road. Just drive up Old Kings Road this weekend and check them out. Scott Meyer, always great to see you. I know you're going to have big crowds out there. So thanks so much for stopping by.
Yeah, of course. Thanks for having me. And we're looking forward to seeing you out there.
In a moment, Florida native Ben Sparacco, now rising the music ranks in Nashville. Don't miss his live in studio performance.
Syria is forced on the defensive after Turkish troops invade the north. Damascus calls America's plan for an open-ended military presence in Syria a devastating mistake. Also, Washington sends a huge delegation to Davos, and the vice president speeds up plans to move America's embassy to Jerusalem. The global edition of the Friday News Roundup next time on 1A. Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
The jellyfish is already one of the world's most feared creatures, and now there is worry it is taking over the oceans. Or is it? I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, the untold story of the jellyfish and some fascinating facts that may even make you like them. Plus, what do snowflakes, diamonds, and chocolate have in common? Want to know? Well, you can find out on the next Science Friday from PRI.
Fridays at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
Mudslide is really the wrong word for what happened in Montecito.
It's almost like a wet concrete type mixture that can end up moving and floating rock the size of a school bus. It'll take out anything in its way, and that's what happened up here.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the round-the-clock recovery industry, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Discover the universal appeal of Shakespeare in Africa's newest nation.
There was a plan to build a replica of Shakespeare's globe in Juba in South Sudan.
Celebrate a five-year trip to every country in Africa.
It's very strange to see a creature that I haven't seen that much in Africa. It's called a tourist.
And explore the pleasures of Normandy on the next Travel with Rick Steves.
Saturday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally this hour, he's a Florida native now based in Nashville, but Ben Spiracco and his band, The New Effect, have been winning praise for being able to blend elements of Americana, blues, folk, and funk. Their latest single, There Is No Them, was released in December, and their national tour includes stops this weekend in our area in Daytona Beach, Tallahassee, and Sunday here in Jacksonville Beach at the Blue Jay Listening Room. Ben and the band are here now live in Studio 5. Hey, guys, good morning.
Hey, how you doing?
Good to see you. And hey, guys, you can say hi, too.
Good morning.
All right, so you're going to be in Daytona, Tallahassee, and then coming back here to Jacksonville Sunday night at Blue Jay. You guys are busy. A lot of traveling.
Yeah, a lot of kind of crossing across the state and going really, doing really weird routing on this tour, but it's fun. This is my home state, so it's fun to kind of travel around zigzag across the state.
So you grew up in South Florida, and this is getting a lot of attention. This is slide guitar, Southern Americana, soul rock. Tell us a little bit about the new album and the new music.
Yeah, so right now we're touring behind a single, There's No Them. And we're working on putting out an EP and then a record. So we're going to have two releases this year. But There's No Them is the first time I've put out music with like the band that I actually tour with, which is these guys over here, Adam DeCipio on bass and Anthony Quirk on drums. Normally I just kind of will hire like just session guys we all live in Nashville, and there's definitely no shortage of great musicians, but there's something to be said about making something in the studio with the band that you kind of live in a van with and play with every night. So sure. We're really excited about that, and that's going to be the single that we have out now is going to be part of the EP that we're putting out hopefully in late March, early April. It'll be a self-titled EP with six songs on it.
Excellent. Well, we're excited to get a preview of your shows this weekend in the area. This is the new single, There Is No Them, from Ben Spiracco and The New Effect. Let's listen.
To me and down the hall, I was living in the haze of a molecular daze, running towards downtown, going the wrong way. But the traffic didn't bother like it normally does. It felt like a game, but a lot more fun. There is no them, only us and what we choose to plan. Now I know that we had it all wrong, but it's all right, we're gonna move along. Just one look, and it won't take long to see what we have to build upon. A desert trip that started it all on Monday night, if I recall. One of those nights where a speaker blows out, but you can't remember how it should sound. A look in the mirror explains it all as your forehead twists and turns while you're standing still. There is no them, only us. That's how it starts and ends. That we had it all wrong, but it's all right, we're gonna move along. Just one look, and it won't take long to see what we have to build upon. Are all curved, but people walk straight. My hands feel numb while my mind depletes. The roads are all curved, but people walk straight. My hands feel numb while my mind depletes. The roads are all curved, but people walk straight. My hands feel numb while my mind depletes. The roads are all curved, but people walk straight. My hands feel numb while my mind depletes. The roads are all curved, but there's no them. There's no them. There's no them. Now I know that we had it all wrong, but it's all right, we're gonna move along. Just one look, and it won't take long to see what we had to build upon.
Beautiful. That's Ben Sparacco and the New Effect Sunday night at the Blue Jay Listening Room in Jacksonville Beach. Great job. You're so talented.
Thank you so much
for being here.
Thank you for having us.
All right. And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.